me pones un ejemplo. Entonces, si tú no quieres hablar conmigo, dímelo para yo no llamarte ni molestarte, porque nada más quedaba tú.
Real talk. Real people. Real stories. The He's Jizz Podcast. Yeah! Welcome, everyone, to another He's Jizz Podcast. I'm your host and founder of the He's Just a Social Worker Movement with another amazing show for you today. But before we get started, I want to remind everyone that this platform was built because way too often as people, we were overlooked or labeled or put in boxes. But this is no longer our plight, and our fight is for anyone and everyone who feels a need to be understood. We are strong as individuals, but unstoppable when we unite. Palliative care is a specialized area of healthcare that is focused on providing relief from the symptoms of pain, stress, or serious illness, regardless of the diagnosis. The primary goal is to improve quality of life for both the patient and their family. Meet Dr. Jarrett Rubenstein, a pediatric palliative care doctor, fellowship program director, and medical educator at Baylor College of Medicine in Texas Children's Hospital. Jarrett uses animation and humor to engage people in conversations about difficult topics. His YouTube channel, which started with a single satirical video, now features educational content on mental health, racism, medicine, and gender equity. In addition to his clinical work, he advocates for palliative care and leads the Discrimination 9/11 Project, training healthcare professionals to combat discrimination. In his downtime, he enjoys traveling and spending time in nature with his lovely family. Jarrett, welcome to our show.
Tell us a little bit about your walk and your journey.
Yeah, so my story was interesting. I mean, it started with never envisioning working in healthcare at all. I was scared of hospitals growing up, and so couldn't go visit if I had a family member that was sick. And so never really considered it as a career, but my dad is an adult pulmonary critical care doctor. My mom's a social worker. And often our dinner table conversations would be like little palliative care interdisciplinary meetings. And you know, my dad would talk not about what I think most look at the heroics of the ICU, but about having the hard conversations and doing end of life care and compassionately taking people off ventilators and following up with families at funerals and just having the needed but hard conversations. And my mom would provide context and that I was just stuck out of my mind as something that felt worthwhile and important, but never really felt like a career option. And then ultimately I ended up finding my way back to medicine later and went into medical school. And when I started medical school, realizing, you know, there is a whole field of medicine that was about the stuff that my parents talked about, which was palliative care. And so I did a palliative care elective and loved it. And then did my pediatric dissertation and loved it and thought, is pediatric palliative care even really a thing? And it wasn't where I was a medical student or a resident, but was able to do an elective at another hospital and just loved it. And that's been my career ever since.
You know, it's interesting. Dinner table talk must have been intense in some way, shape or form. You may have been had to pick sides. I'm voting for mom. Obviously, I have bias with that. But nevertheless, I think that guided your walk in that you were able to kind of lend more to having these difficult conversations. I want to talk a little bit more about that. Can you help our listeners understand what is palliative care and how is it different, like from hospice care, if you will?
Yeah, it's a great question. It's such a common question and a common misconception, both in the general public and in the healthcare field. And so palliative care, I think of as sort of the big picture, the umbrella. It's we take care of and meet any person or family with a serious illness, and we can help with pain and symptom management. We make sure that their quality of life is as good as possible while they're dealing with their illness. We can help with communication and medical understanding. We know that hospitals and doctors aren't always the best at communicating and explaining things. So part of our role is sort of doing that medical interpretation piece for patients and families. We all work together to make sure that, you know, that healthcare can be sort of a machine or a conveyor belt, and we want to make sure that somebody's goals and values and priorities are honored and that they get healthcare in a way that makes sense for them, in a way that fits with their goals and values. And so part of our aim is to get to know people as best as possible and get to know what's important, what makes them tick, who they are as people, and then make sure that the healthcare they're getting kind of fits in with that. And then we also do take care of patients who are at the end of their life and support families through that. And then hospice really is the way that we provide palliative care to someone who's near the end of their life, often in their home. And so hospice is sort of under the umbrella of palliative care, but to get palliative care and to be eligible, there's not the strict criteria like a hospice. You don't have to be near the end of your life. You don't have to have decided you're not going to do curative or disease directed therapies. It just means that you're somebody that's having a hard time with an illness, which is really anyone that has a serious illness.
Yeah. Telling us a little bit more about that was very helpful, because I believe that the nuances for patients and people who do understand think that, well, this is the end. If I go here, this happens. And I guess that it's not over. It's still going to be difficult. But I think that you and your team are really concerned about bringing that high quality care. Could you speak to us a little bit about that quality care and what that looks like?
Absolutely. So palliative care at heart is an interprofessional field. We know that when somebody's suffering, there can be physical suffering, there can be emotional suffering, there can be spiritual suffering. And so we're a big team. So we've got doctors, we've got nurses and nurse practitioners, we've got social workers, we've got a chaplain. And our goal is to kind of be that extra layer of support. We have a psychologist to help with more of the mental health element of serious illness. And when we meet someone, our goal is to really meet them where they're at and see what's going on. So are they having challenging symptoms? Are they having pain? Are they having breathlessness from their illness? Are they having challenging side effects to manage? And we can use our medical expertise to help manage both symptoms from the disease and symptoms from the side effects that are part of their treatment. We lean on our psychosocial spiritual folks, so the social workers, chaplains, and psychologists, to really build out that picture of sort of the person as a whole. What social challenges are they having? Are there financial challenges? What are their relationships been like in the setting of the illness, and how has that been? And then meeting somewhere where that with their spirituality, do they have a faith that provides them a source of comfort and support? Do they have a faith that is causing them distress? Are they not religious, but they just sort of are having existential angst relative to their spirituality? And our chaplains are great at meeting people where they're at and those goals. And really what makes us interprofessional and what I think makes palliative care team special is that we tend to do our work together. And at least I know on my team, we kind of round as a posse. So there's a doctor or a nurse, there's a social worker, there's a chaplain, and we're seeing people sort of in the same place at the same time and kind of bouncing ideas off each other and sort of having conversations all together while we're meeting with this the child and family to see how we can support sort of in the biggest sense possible for whatever's going on.
Hmm. Can you help us understand how that referral process happens? So someone may be in ER, goes into trauma, something happens, or how does that usually wind up?
Yeah. And so we get referred to or consulted just like any medical specialty. So if the primary medical team is seeing someone and they have heart troubles, they call a cardiologist. If they have lung troubles, they call the pulmonologist. And if they have just sort of any of the things that we just talked about, if there's benefit for pain or other symptoms, if there's just psychological or spiritual angst, they can consult the palliative care team and we can help be that support for whatever they're going through. And so we just get called like any other medical specialty. Sometimes I get questions saying like, oh, are you covered in my insurance benefit, or am I signed up for palliative care now? And it's not a sort of a process you sign up for. It's a medical specialty like any of the other ones. And we all work together in the hospital and healthcare system.
So as we're trying to arm our families, we walk around now with the ability to use Dr. Google and ask questions and begin to inquire about what is the best way to do this and that. And there's always a family member, thankfully, that's always involved, or really understands how to at least press and get questions and try to get these things to happen. For me, is this work that you do is definitely difficult. And how is it that you find the joy to do this? Because every day you are walking into the unexpected. What is that brings you joy?
Yeah, no, great question. And it's really a few things. One is that there's a lot of joy in the work itself. So certainly we're seeing people going through hard things, but every day I get to meet wonderful children and families and be part of their lives at this challenging time and learn about their stories, learn about their families, sort of see what brings them joy each day and try to empower that and make more of that. So the work in itself can be joyful. For the parts that are hard, we do see a lot of serious illness and a lot of children dying and families sort of going through that bereavement process. And a lot of times people assume, you know, if you're a palliative care doctor or work in palliative care, you're going to be this sad, broken person. And then they meet us and we're not. And we often we see people being surprised at how much they enjoy working with our team when we get visitors from other specialties. And I think a big part of what we do is that we normalize the hard stuff and that we talk about it. And we talk about it a lot. So we support each other when we go see a patient and family. If it's a particularly challenging visit, before we run over to see the next patient, we'll take 5 minutes and sit down at a table and talk with each other and say, you know, how was that? how was that for you? How do you feel? Is there anything you're struggling with now? And sort of navigate and give each other that sort of in the moment support and be able to process something in the way that I think that in general in medicine, we don't do a really good job of. And we're all in medical school taught to kind of just shove stuff down and not talk about it and go do the next thing. And a lot of times we push back about that. And I think there's this culture in medicine that you don't have time to eat, you don't have time to go to the bathroom, you don't have time to do anything other than care for your patients. And I'm always the first one to say, like, you know, one of the hills I'll die on is that I don't think you can be a very good doctor if you have a full bladder and an empty stomach. If you're not taking a little bit of time to take care of yourself and your colleagues during the day, you're probably not doing the best job taking care of your patients either. And I think that I work on our team to really kind of push back against the culture of medicine and normalize that. And so some of it is just supporting each other in the work and creating space for that. Some of it is, and I kind of revel to some extent in our culture of toxic positivity, where everyone's just told to kind of buck up and not worry about it and everything will be okay. I love that we create space for people to kind of be with the full range of motion, sort of like the whole premise of the movie Inside Out, that like, you can't just have joy all the time. You need to have a little bit of everything. And I love that our team is one of the teams that creates space for people to lean into the harder emotions as well. And then in being able to process and talk about it at work and do those things and leave it on the field to some extent, it lets me, when I get home from the hospital, not necessarily have it all in my mind so much. And I can get home to my wife and kids and be able to be in that moment as much as possible and have the joy of that because I've had that sort of break and time to process it before I go home from work.
Yeah. Once again, big up to you and to your team. I know that this work is one that requires a team approach. There's no way that it can't be done correctly without you having to bounce ideas off your team. And I think that that's what draws me most to you is your humble approach to how you do things. And we'll tap into some of the other great aspects of your work and creativity. But I think that I want to remain here about this multidisciplinary work that we do. People cannot understand that maybe you are the one that's facing the family, but you are voicing and listening and taking into account what your social worker said, with the anesthesia, with whoever you're working with, you're kind of pressing that menu against the family member. And I want to lift up your work in that way because it has to happen like in the blink of an eye. You have a family member who's here. Sometimes you have the opportunity to plan for rounds, you get a referral, but I'm sure that there are times that things do happen. And when they do, you have to have that kind of reaction that is, you know, applicable for the family member to digest, but also to have the opportunity to say, listen, I want to give this person my best shot. I don't want to come off like I'm reading off a chart and just saying to them, well, listen, you know, the way I see it, I've done this work for 10 years. And the reason why, you know, that approach to me really scares families and really puts us in a powerless kind of position. And what I've learned from you early is that you want to empower your families. So you're sharing your knowledge, you're giving them these strategies, and then you're doing it with a smile. So one more time, big up to you and to your team for that. I want to talk more about your partnership and the way that you handle this work. When you say, I partner with you in your illness, you truly mean that. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I always sort of joke that everyone's all excited about personalized medicine and doing this like genome sequencing and you'll be able to get the exact right medicine that works for you because we'll know all of your genetics. And I always kind of joke and say, you know, we do personalized medicine every day because we talk to people and we find out what's important to them. And, you know, the question I start often when I meet someone for the first time is what a team in Canada created as part of called the dignity question. And it's just, what do I need to know about you to take the best care of you possible? Mm-hmm. And I love that question. I think I'll say something like, and make it, people are so used to talking about their medical stuff. Sometimes I'll find if I say, tell me about yourself, people are like, well, I was diagnosed in 2008. And then like, people assume that doctors want to know about their medical history. And so I'll sometimes say, you know, like, I've read your chart, I know the medical stuff, I want to know about you as a person. And so tell me about you. Tell me, what do I need to know about you to take the best care of you possible? And in pediatrics, sometimes I'm talking to the patient themselves, but often I'm talking to the parents. And often I'm talking to parents who have been part of the system for a long time and have children, whether it's cancer or neurological disease or a serious neurological impairment or lung disease that they've been dealing with for their entire life. And I'm meeting them sort of at a low point because they're in the hospital and they're sick enough to be coming to see me. And so one of my favorite things to do, and one something I found that really builds connection and helps me learn about the person is ask what their life like is at home. You know, what's a good day, what's a bad day? And because everyone has a little permanent camera in their pocket all the time now. I'll say, you know, can I see some pictures of your kid at home or some videos? And I love doing that because it sort of lets me do three things. One, selfishly, it makes my day better to see these cute pictures of kids and videos of them doing their thing at home. I think it builds rapport with the family because every parent loves showing pictures and videos of their kid. But then the big part is it really gives us a sense of who they are as a person, and it lets us see what their baseline is. And I can say to families, you know, thanks so much for sharing that with me. Now we know what we're working back towards when we can get you better. And it lets me kind of plant a seed for later. If I get worried that maybe they're not going to be able to get back to what I saw on the video, I can come back to that and say, you know, like, I remember when you showed me this video of life at home. Is it okay if I share with you one of my worries? Here's why I'm worried. You might not be able to get back to that. And it lets us leverage sort of some of the harder conversations by anchoring them again in kind of who they are as a person and what makes them tick and what makes their life worth living.
Obviously, we've learned early that this is going to be difficult throughout. It's not going to be seamless. There are miracles. There are things that can't happen in your favor. But what I took away from your response is the word possible. And that glimpse of hope, I think, remains there. I do also admire that you're able to sit, stand, walk with a family, do what you need to do to let them be themselves. And even though that this is a process that is extremely difficult, I want our listeners to understand when we have to go through such a situation, family members are here for days, weeks, without properly taking care of themselves. They're rotating. They're thinking about how to think of a plan. The father's in the hospital. Mom goes to take care of maybe the other child. They're running in between schedules. This is extremely difficult. And once again, you know, saluting those families that are able to deal with this and kind of create a structure, if you will. But I think that they're able to create that possibility, which is what I think that you want to at least go away with. You know, we're in this era now that we just walk up to you, say, is it good or bad? Like, we don't even want to know anything. It's just like anything else that we're doing now in life. We don't want the surprises. We want to know things instantly. And I think that we're losing ourselves in that touch. We need to really go back to understanding this is something that's happened. How can we best support our family, myself, and also your team? Because it doesn't help for us to come in there blaming you, using probably projection of some sort of feelings that don't relate to you. And you're really trying to dig into the work. So using those videos and those cameras and those pics to kind of allow you to walk into their lives is very important. And I do encourage any families who are listening that they should practice this in any type of way, whether your child broke an arm or like a leg, please use that because it does empower the patient, but it also empowers the team to say, okay, here's my baseline. And these are the things I want to try to get to. So once again, big up to you. Tell us a little bit about your team. Who are these people on your team and what are their roles?
Yeah. So we've got several doctors on the team that focus on kind of the medical parts of palliative care. So having the big picture medical decision-making conversations and that decision support and planning for the future, helping with pain and symptom management and using our medical expertise to use different medicines and non-pharmacologic techniques to make sure that people are as comfortable as possible with whatever they're going through. We've got social workers that help with, you know, strategize the sort of what I've learned from our social workers is looking at people through that strength-based lens and seeing people at their best and seeing what strengths they're bringing to the table that then we can leverage to help them thrive in the setting of their illness. Helping out, think about the resource piece. So our social workers are great at when we're talking about all the medical stuff, just sitting down with the family and looking at the parents and saying, are you eating? Like, have you eaten today? Do you have enough to eat? Are you taking care of yourself? Are you giving yourself permission to leave the hospital at all? Just really helping the families be able to give themselves permission to think about themselves, which is hard when your kid's sick in the hospital. I can't imagine doing work in a vacuum without this team. I mean, I always say when I'm working on the weekend and it's just me because just the doctors cover on the weekends, it always feels like I'm doing it wrong. It feels like I'm doing an incomplete job of palliative care when I'm seeing patients and families alone. We have our chaplain that just does an incredible job of really holding space for people and helping them process their religious or spiritual angst or distress and sort of spiritual meaning making. So whether it's providing a baptism for someone who's near the end of life that they haven't been able to do before, or giving them space to kind of process their spiritual angst, helping them celebrate their holidays when they're in the hospital, or collaborating and leveraging community support to have, because all the chaplains are cross-trained to be able to support people of all different faiths, but sometimes people want someone from their specific faith. So helping bring someone in from the community to do that. We have wonderful nurses and nurse practitioners that function in sort of a similar way that we do as the doctors on the team helping out with the medical piece. But as our nurse practitioners often recommend me, that they're the best of both worlds. I have all, everything that the doctors can do and the nurses can do and sort of give fully comprehensive care. We have a psychologist on our team that can help and be that high level psychological support for the people that are really dealing with distress, whether it's the child or the family. We have an amazing administrative team that helps us sort of make sure we're not forgetting all the things we need to remember. We've got great research coordinators that help those of us on the team that do research projects to make sure that can all work. And we've got great leadership. We have bosses that really make sure that we're doing great work and that we're giving ourselves permission to take care of ourselves too, just like we aspire to do for our families. And so it's, I feel like I lucked into sort of the best possible team, and I'm grateful to work with these folks every day.
So big up to them once again. And funny enough, you know, a lot of us, when we're trying to break down scenarios, and it's funny because we as people always are getting caught up in the, you know, personal aspect of this. What is this going to cost me? You know, and obviously when it's a situation like this, you were talking about our babies caught up in situations that we wish that it was us and not them. But funny enough, children have this ability of resilience. They have this ability to show armor that we never are capable of. And I know that you have a ton of inspiring words and quotes and drawings and things that they probably have left behind. But I want families to feel encouraged that when we're going through this process, think about all the people that are being employed to work on your child. So think about the power of you joining that team, being accessible in any way. What are things you can add to this team? And I think we started thinking about that before. What are things that my son or daughter really enjoys? What are things that they like? So that you can probably maximize that quality of care to ease that situation and probably build up that resilience. I want to talk about some of your superpowers because there are many. But let's talk about this superpower about animation. You walked into a scenario that you created a way of bringing animation, and these animated gems really speak to real difficult conversations. And I looked at a few. Let's just talk about this particular one for adults. End of the line. Here is a wearisome lady who's on the train. And there's another lady who's there. And I think that she calls out, end of the line. And there's a scenario, there's an exchange about, no, this is not my stop. I need to keep going. Can you walk us through a little bit about that? And what was your thought process for that?
Yeah, so that was a video that one of my favorite things about making these animations has been building connections and collaborations with people that I admire. And so the end of the line is one of the few that I've gotten to partner with Catherine Mannix, who's a British palliative care doctor. And I think one of my favorite speakers on palliative care and public educators about palliative care. And the goal is using that metaphor of people on a train talking about the end of the line and not being prepared when they get there, because in our culture, we're not good at talking about that stuff and we're not good at looking into the future. And I think there's always this superstition sense that if we talk about something scary, it'll happen. And our goal in palliative care is really to help everyone be as prepared as possible. And so that video is just a little sort of satirical analogy to help people prepare for that journey. And that's part of our work is, you know, giving people permission to talk about the scary things ahead. And we hear, and some people really don't. And for people that don't, we don't want to push them. We don't want to make people think about something that they don't want to think about. But often what we see is that people want to know, and that our medical culture, particularly in children, but for adults as well, tries to protect them from that. And toxic positivity is rife in medicine too. And thinking about, you know, people have questions, people deserve information, people feel what's happening to their body, even if nobody's talking to them about it, and giving them the tools so that they can live their best life possible, I think includes talking to them about what's happening and what to expect in the future. And I think the only thing worse than something really bad happening to someone is something really bad happening slowly that they could have been prepared for and weren't. And so we hear from families all the time how helpful it is to be able to talk about the future and plan for the future and know what to expect. because most people want to. And I think we need to give them that permission. And like I said, not force things down their throat if they don't want to. But for those that do, trust them enough that they can handle it, and that knowledge is power, and equipping them with that and being able to help them think through how to prepare for the rest of their life, I think is really important, and people deserve it.
I'm going to say that there is a slew of videos there. Please let us know, how do we tap into your YouTube channel to follow and be able to catch on these stories? Because it's not only about having the opportunity to survive. There are so many other things that you have in there. Could you share with us what the YouTube video links are?
Sure. Yeah. You can just go to the site YouTube and type my name, Jared Rubenstein. And then also it links to it from my website, jaredrubensteinmd.com.
You know, one of the things that I saw early in this was like, and you probably did it just out of the sake to support patients, and you thought to yourself, yeah, I'm going to create a way. Oh, this one video is cool. Oh, you know, people seem to like that. And you walk into something. How did you know that you were on to something that was positive, that like propelled you? How many videos did it take or whatnot?
So at first I really didn't, and I didn't even intend to have this be a video project. It kind of all started with the original one I made called the palliative care, where the fire department is started kind of out of frustration, like I think most good things start from. And I was coming back from a consult request, and it was like a lot of the consult requests that we get, that, you know, I mentioned that as that a lot of the stigma and fear about palliative care and talking about this stuff comes from other healthcare workers. And so I got called by another doctor that said, you know, we want you to meet this family, but, you know, maybe don't say your palliative care, and maybe just talk about pain, and don't talk about anything scary, and don't take away hope. And also, have you considered changing the name of your specialty? Mm. And it was just the 100th one of a parade of consult requests like that. And I started walking back to the office frustrated and thinking that it's sort of like if you called the fire department but said, don't talk about fire because I don't want you to scare the people whose house is burning down, as if they're not already maximally scared. And remembered seeing some of these online animations in the past about other things. And I thought, oh, maybe I could make one of those. And I found a little program and made this animation and showed some folks on my team and ended up putting it out on social media. And it sort of went palliative care viral, which is like normal viral, but for a very niche audience. And it really resonated with people. And people said, you know, this is exactly my day every day, and we can't wait to see what you do next. And I said, oh, no, there's no next. I just made this one video. And then got some really positive encouragement from colleagues I admire who said, you know, you should do more of these. And I thought, maybe there's more out there. And it kind of became a thing that started out as part of my self-care, that if something frustrating would happen at the hospital, I'd see if I could channel it into a video. And realizing that, you know, as someone that grew up on The Simpsons and South Park, using animation to kind of be disarming a little bit and catch people off guard and then talk about something serious or impactful, I've always been a big believer in. And being able to do that with this about palliative care and serious illness was great. And then it kind of spiraled into other things. And I started getting requests to do other topics. And we did some about sort of the weaponization of the term professionalism in healthcare, and some about gender equity, and some about mental health care and the stigma of mental health care among healthcare workers. And the biggest collaboration actually became somebody reached out, and a doctor I really admire, who said, you know, would you be interested in talking about my experience of racism in healthcare as a Black physician? And we put together a collaboration and actually made a whole spin-off YouTube channel called the Anti-Racism Animation Series, really focusing on the prevalence of racism in medicine and trying to teach people sort of anti-racist policies.
I'm going to let everyone know once again that YouTube channel is fire. And you actually sent me one with the social workers, which I thought were incredible. There's a way to get information, and then there's a way to get information. And while you're enjoying it, you're smiling, you're kind of, your mind is like, wow, I didn't think of this. It's so evasive. You get an opportunity to get real, uncut, true information. And I like that you said, listen, I am not going to sugarcoat this. I'm not going to put this in a place where if I need to tell you the truth, you rather know the truth or you rather know nothing at all. And I think that when we begin this journey of health, no matter what it is, including a headache, we come from a place of anger, and we start there, just as you said. And the anger narrows our mindset. It stops us from really looking at the bigger picture. Sometimes it takes us a moment. It takes us to speak to someone who is positive to get us out of it. Sometimes it takes someone from your team to encourage that. And I truly understand that the difficulty of this, no one wants to see their child have to be in such a situation. But once again, Some of these things are dealt because we have the capacity to, right? If the energies are correct and things are happening, you know, they say everything happens for a reason. There needs to be a truth that's uncovered in your team. You and your team are doing an exceptional job. I'm looking forward to more of these videos, obviously, because when we talk about the essence of getting information, there never could be enough. But you touched on the subject that's really important. When you look at those microaggressions, and we're talking about, you know, racism within any setting, becomes very uncomfortable. And those of us who have experienced it to some degree really feel shook that it's still 2024 and we still have conversations about the same topic. Tell us a little bit about how difficult that is yet for you, whether you share at home, whether you talk to your parents about it, maybe it's your team. What gets you most upset that this situation continues to happen? And let us in a little bit on that.
Yeah, I mean, I think for me, early in my career, this wasn't something I thought about a lot. And I think like a lot of white people, it wasn't something that was really on my radar. And then with George Floyd's murder in 2020, I think became alerted to something that I should have been alerted to a long time ago. And it started with just sort of dipping my toes in and partnering with some teammates to say, you know, we need to learn more about this. And we started what we called an anti-racist book club on our team. And knowing that nobody ever reads a whole book, we were like, let's make it multimedia. And so each week we would commit to picking a topic, and the three of us would pick a short YouTube video, a podcast, and a short article to read and send them out to the team and say, you know, the three of us are going to get together at lunch and talk about this. Anyone who wants to come, just check out these resources and come. And to our team's credit, they really showed up, and it was awesome. And we leaned in and had a lot of really uncomfortable conversations and learned and unlearned a lot together. And then actually a resident, one of the training doctors who was rotating through our team, came to one of those book clubs and came to me after and said, you know, you guys seem like you're talking about this. What do I do when a patient or a family says something racist to my colleague and I'm standing there? And I said, I don't know. That sounds awful, but we're happy to help think about it. And ended up putting together a group, and the few of us that were part of that original book club, then partnering with some other folks that had more both lived experience and true academic experience in DEI work. We partnered up and created what became Discrimination 911, which is a workshop in communication we do to teach people how to respond and stand up and speak out when they see racism, either from a patient or family in healthcare, or more commonly from our colleagues. And at heart, I think speaking out against this stuff and teaching people how to upstand is inherently tied in with institutional wellness, which is such a hot buzzword now. Because if you're coming to work and you're having to face discrimination from your colleagues or your patients, you're not going to be well at work. And we always talk about wanting to hire for diversity, but if you don't mirror that and pair that with inclusion and belonging, you don't have anything, and your diverse hires quit. And so at heart, as we've done this work over the last few years, we've seen it that our goal is really to create a culture of institutional belonging where everyone can show up and be their whole self and bring their whole self to work and know that inevitably when a patient, family, or colleague says something racist or otherwise discriminatory, your colleagues are going to have your back. And our goal over the last few years has been to kind of roll out this training throughout our institution. And we've been partnering with some folks at other institutions to try to bring it there as well. And it's been cool that it's really changed the way we talk as a team. It's changed the way we think about each other. It's changed the way we think about our colleagues. It's changed the way we think about our patients and families to see them and be able to name all these unspoken things. Like, you know, are you worried that you've been treated differently because of the color of your skin or the way you look? Let's do something about that. Talking about, you know, with our colleagues, empowering them to be themselves. And I've just been grateful to be able to have a space in it and learn so much from my colleagues who I've partnered with in this, who have taught me more than I've taught them, for sure.
Extremely difficult work as well, because you're working side by side by people who you may not have had ability to really read any of that, because the work happens so fast and there are things that you may or may not pick up on. And I know that now if it becomes apparent, it may make the work environment feel a little bit different. You know, throwing words out here, the way things feel now, equity and excellence follows a lot of our vision statements within our workplaces, and hospitals are no different to that. It's such a big location, and we try to diversify these staffs and the way we do the work. But frankly, there's still not enough that's done. And sadly, there's still more to do. So even from an aspect of a patient who walks in and there's a dire scenario, finding an adequate interpreter who can really relay, because even if I'm speaking in Spanish and I'm translating, I get lost in translation just by, if I'm looking at the doctor's hand movements, body language, facial expressions, and then the person who is conveying the message didn't have that kind of expression, I kind of feel like, are they really telling me the truth? Or is this person mad and the other one is trying to fix it so I won't read that? So there's a lot that happens for us in the middle of when those things happen. So landing there, Jared, is extremely difficult for us because the end user comes in. And the first thing that we do, like I walk in or someone of color walks in, okay, I know it's a white doctor and this, you know, all these things happen instantly. So long the first no comes out of the doctor's mouth or something that we can't, you know, commend you on or, you know, change for you becomes a difficult conversation. So also for you and your team, I understand that that's extremely difficult. And for you and the ones who are trying to push this work, it must be extremely difficult because now you have the patients who may not or know or probably won't understand that you're working with them or advocating for it. And then you have internal issues with colleagues who are like, this guy has broke the code, went against, I can't believe it. So those conversations are extremely tough. And I am hoping that you and your team find, you know, solace in some way with other team members to join, because it sounds like there's a lot more to be done here. But again, I definitely applaud you and your, you know, team for doing this. Let's talk more about the Discrimination 911 project. Aside from the gains that you've already gotten, what are still some growth areas that you believe are still happening in the medical field with microaggressions, not only at your place, just any place in general that you can probably think about?
Yeah. And so I think the medical field is no different than the rest of society. I think they're happening all the time. And I think it's harder when there's a serious illness or it's colleagues that you have to work with all the time, but I think it's all the more reason to talk about it. And our goal is really just to have more of these conversations. And I think if something's hard to talk about, that's probably all the more reason to talk about it. And so we're a small team. It's really been the five of us that have sort of created this training and are doing it. And we're in a big giant institution. So our goal is always to give more workshops and to train more people, give them the skill set, give them these communication tools to be able to upstand, but also to train more trainers. And that's what we've been working on now is so hoping it doesn't have to be the five of us for much longer, and that there's other people, and we've had some good success bringing other folks on board who are passionate about this work and want to learn the tools, and then bringing it to other institutions. We just got back, my partner and I, from doing a training at another children's hospital with the goal of hopefully having folks at that hospital be able to kind of take this up and to take it and train there. And my hope too is that it'll, like anything that's good, will be sort of tweaked and modified and adapted and improved. There's part of me that feels like I maybe taken it as far as I can, and other than continuing to do this work, hoping other people take this project and make it better and use it in scenarios we hadn't thought about, or to make the role play scenarios we do better, or to tweak the communication to make it work in different settings. And my hope is that sort of the people, whoever's interested, kind of take it and run with it and adapt and improve it.
Well, we're sending positive energy your way for you and for your team, obviously, because I understand that the lift is heavy. And while you're continuing to do this work, again, you're enmeshed in situations that are really too complicated to even begin here to list. You are always a person who comes from a place of, you know, we're team oriented. We want to do something. But there's something about you that we've already understood is that you really do believe in this work. In the way that you perceive the patients that you service, it's a real special treat to have a doctor who can do that. Let's talk about your place of venue. You have this personal statement. I believe that every child deserves thoughtful, compassionate, person-centered healthcare, and their dignity and personhood should be maintained throughout their experience in the healthcare system. Wow. Tell us a little bit more about that statement for you.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think anyone that's had any experience in the healthcare system, which I suspect is most people, knows how dehumanizing it is, and that you become a number, you become a disease, you become a bed space. And we historically in medicine aren't good at seeing people as people. And I think we have to push back against that and try as hard as we can. I think there's also data that medical training itself is dehumanizing. They've shown that people over the course of the 4 years of medical school are less human by the end of it than they are at the beginning, which is so sad. And it's, to some extent, it feels like it's a hurt people thing, that people go through this dehumanizing process to become doctors and then dehumanize the people they're taking care of. And I think we should at every step be working to sort of bring that humanity back. And I think there's so many cool organizations that's been sort of their mission, is to rehumanize healthcare. And it's a big lift, because there's some pushback. There's also just a lot of hidden curriculum and stuff that's been part of the system for a long time. But I think we deserve to be seen as whole people, as doctors. And I think what we saw in the COVID pandemic was that wasn't happening. We went very quickly from being heroes that people were banging pots and clapping for to pharma shills and whatever else people were saying, that I think we're not good as a society at seeing each other as people. And I think we should try as hard as we can in healthcare spaces and in all spaces. But my sphere of healthcare and medical education is that we should be making sure our training doesn't dehumanize us and helping our trainees stay human throughout the process. And we should be working to humanize our patients and their families and give them opportunities to humanize themselves so that they can bring their whole self to being a patient. We can bring our whole selves to our work, taking care of them. And instead of doctor and patient, it'll be sort of just two people talking to each other and trying to heal. And I think we have a long way to go.
But extremely powerful. You know, you already had me at personhood. I was like, come on now, you ain't playing that game. For me, it's the whole person all of the time. And I know that you may say the right things like, well, I try to take care of myself and I go home. But we are now understanding that this is not that easy, that you're going to go home and think about a patient, that you and your team are going to call each other. I know that we promised not, but did we get the chart? Did we get, you know, there's so much that happens and people don't really understand that. So I am pushing that our listeners who are coming up against this tough battle, that palliative care should be looked at not as a service, but a unity of your family. These are borrowed family members that you have for this given time that can help you spread that empowerment. One of the ways that we show gratitude to you and to your team is showing up and saying really thoughtful things like thank you, because you guys are total strangers. And within hours, you are the tightest people that like we're seeing in our entire lives. Our children are dependent. Their lives are dependent on you. So there's a lot of positive things that should be said towards you. Tell us a little bit more about this work, because I understand you've seen so many cases. There's been so much that goes into this work. Are there cases that really stick out for you the most? Is there a particular case that you can share with us that really says to you, Jared, man, this is the why I'm going to continue to do this work? Tell us about that.
Yeah, I mean, so many. I try not to talk too much about specific ones, because our patients are so unique that they're all kind of identifiable. But I think, you know, anytime, I think the best compliment we get is when we meet people and then things take a turn for their worse in their care. And they ask us, they call for us. They say, you know, we want you to be here with us for this hardest part of things. I think some of those hard conversations we were talking about and kind of planning for the future, I think oftentimes bringing that up can feel really fraught. And people, it's not always met with something. It's not something people want to talk about. And I think some of the most satisfying things were when I see someone days or weeks or months later and they say, you know, I was annoyed when you brought this up, but I'm really glad you made me think about this, because like now I know what my child wanted when we'd never talked about it before, or I knew what I wanted and I'd never thought about it before. And so the proof of the work, of feeling like the hard conversations are worthwhile and they're appreciated, and being able to be told, you know, I appreciate you. I appreciate you making me think about this. I appreciate you giving me courage to lean into the hard thing are so satisfying. And as a teacher, I think something else that's incredibly satisfying is when, you know, I'm able to go and say, for the trainees that come through, and I've had a medical student and a resident that came through and said, you know, after working with your team for a week on this elective, I feel like this is the kind of, like, you're being doctors the way I thought I wanted to be a doctor before I went into medical school and saw how it really is. And I think seeing that, my hope is, you know, we're bringing out the best in our patients and we're bringing out the best in our colleagues and in giving them the ability to sort of provide this comprehensive whole person care.
It's a beautiful thing. And one that I honor, you know, my mom passed away about a year ago and I called her doctor, you know, during her birthday or something, to remind them, hey, how are you? just want to let you know today was a birthday or something would have happened. I think that brings that personhood that we're talking about to life, because making that connection, it still allows me to kind of feel that she's still around and that I'm lifting her name up in a way with someone who last saw her or who showed me that kind of human side of things, that continuously worked hard to keep her last days be the best or the best treatment to be available, never said no, tried options and never gave up. So salute to you and to all the providers who are doing this work, because I think that is a gigantic lift. And if we find ways to honor these people who are doing this work, it really goes a long way. So thank you for really sharing that. I know that you talk about going out in nature and enjoying family. What are the things you do for self-care? How do you take care of self?
Yeah, so exercise has been really important for me. Like I like trying to stay in shape and having a way to burn off energy and frustration at the gym. Doing that family time. So I've got a wonderful wife and a 6-year-old son and a 2-year-old daughter, and being together at home, doing family trips, trying to hike, even when our son says, you know, walking's not really my thing, trying to get him out and have him walk around and do some hiking has been great. Just a chance to kind of be outside, be all together, be away from all the sad and hard stuff that's happening. Mm-hmm. Therapy. I have my own therapist, and I think just having someone you can check in with and talk to and have that time to get your own support for going through something hard, I can't say enough good things about. And I think just really any the combination of those things and really just having my wife and kids is kind of a grounding space to not have to do work there, not have to think about what happened at the hospital, just to be able to be together and sort of focus on presence, which is not my strong suit, but it's kind of a forcing of presence when your family needs you for stuff, and being able to be there and just enjoy time with them has been great.
Good times. Thanks for sharing. Hiking is not my thing, so don't be mad at your son as well. But nevertheless, I think that you're bringing in great stories about how you do things. And it sounds to me like every doctor in the world works out. Things are different. I remember growing up, doctors weren't in shape. Now everyone's doing it, telling people how to do it. So I'm super lucky and proud to have worked with all these doctors that remain in shape. What are things that you are noticing in your field, you know, palliative care, this is going right, this is trending in the right direction, or what are areas that you're like, man, we should go away with this? Why are we still doing this?
Yeah. So, I mean, the things we should go away with is this projected stigma of palliative care from other healthcare workers. I think that's something that needs to go away. And it's something that has been sort of a big part of my work in advocacy and education over these last few years, is sort of getting rid of that stigma that consulting the palliative care team means you failed, or that it's only for people that are dying, or it's going to take away hope, sort of pushing back on those stigma. And I think the success, the stuff I'm really excited to see is that I think it really is getting better with the next generation. I mean, I think for everyone that hates on millennials and Gen Z, I think they're bringing a lot of great things to medicine. And I think one of the most satisfying things that happened to me in the last few weeks, I was teaching some of the trainees in a different specialty at our hospital. And they said, you know, we're so excited for this palliative care lecture. And I said, really? Like, nobody's ever so excited for the palliative care lecture. And they're like, no, we are. And I said, why? And they said, you know we need to learn this. And we know our senior doctors can't teach us this because it wasn't part of their training. And it wasn't something that they knew about when they were in school or medical training. And so that gives me so much hope for the next generation of medicine. And I think medicine is going to become more human. I think we are going to get better at supporting people and seeing them as whole people. Because, and I think there's been a big pushback to that, and I think it's working. That's the most heartening thing I've seen, is that I think the stigma of palliative care, I hope, is going away. I think there's a lot of people doing work to try to make it go away and keep it that way, which I'm grateful for. But I think even outside of palliative care, I think the younger generation of healthcare workers seem to be embracing the work and embracing that whole person-centered care in a way that we haven't historically in medicine.
I know you talked about your dream team earlier, but tell us a little bit about spirituality and how does that work within your own team? I know that we're working with families to try to support them and what their beliefs are. Is there spirituality within the realm, and in which way? Do we call the chaplain? Like, what are we doing?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, in our team, we come from all different faiths and spiritualities. And our goal really is just to support each other and celebrate each other in whatever that looks like. And then I think also being able to, when we go see patients and families, to leave it at the door, because I think if we're projecting our faith or spirituality onto somebody else's illness journey, we're doing it wrong. And so I think being able to sort of help bring out where their strength comes from, and then supporting them in it however way it works for them. And I think doing that for each other too, that, you know, celebrating each other's faiths or spiritualities, and then we all lean into it to sort of varying degrees. And for me, I think the goal is always just to give people space to be who they are, and whether they have a faith tradition that supports them, whether they don't, whatever gives them strength in their life and wherever they find support, that's where I want to help them sort of channel, whether it's my patients and their families or my colleagues.
You know, going back to the pioneers in your life, mom and dad, you know, these guys, you look like you came off a spin. Dad's technique and logistics to kind of do things, and then mom's whole person style. How much do you think of them when you're doing this work, and who comes up more, mom or dad or both, or how are you working around that? Because I know that your own person, you got your own animation things that they were different, but how do they play into what you do still? And what do you want to say to them?
A lot. I mean, I think whenever people ask me, where does my palliative care origin story start? It always starts at their dinner table. I think I'd like to think I took the best of both of them, and that both of them are present in my work. And I mean, I think they're still very present in my life. Recently, they moved near us in Houston a few years ago, which has been wonderful to be able to see them more regularly after. I grew up in New York and would see them on holidays and we'd talk a lot, but being able to see them daily in our life and having them be part of my kids' life has been huge over the last few years. Mm. So that's just been so nice. And so I think they're a big part of my life, but they're definitely a big part of my work, because I think it's hard to, I'm not sure I would have ended up in the field I'm in without having that origin and sort of hearing about, they didn't even know the word palliative care at the time, and they didn't know that's what they were talking about, but it very much was. And I think sort of having the way that both of them thought about sort of seeing people as people and that whole person model of medicine, I think is sort of was the foundation for why I got interested in this work in the first place.
Amazing stuff. Obviously, based on your like track record, you left, went to Texas and never came back. I don't think they're coming back either. Whoever goes to Houston stays there. So nevertheless, big up to them. I'm thinking about you. There's so much that you may or may not have thought of. You've already created a legacy in so many different ways. What's in store for you? Like, what do you want to do next? And I know you do some research. I know you do some writing, but what's up for you?
I don't know. I mean, I think I've been really honored over the last really just 6 months or so. I've started getting invited to give talks at other places about palliative care, about this messaging, about, you know, having, I sort of think of it as like the No More Mr. Nice Guy palliative care talk, that I think we should own our space and own our expertise and push back to all the stigma and bias when we're told, oh, the family's not ready for you yet, or you're going to take away hope, or you're just the death team. I think because of our work, we've gotten comfortable saying, oh, you know, and sort of apologizing for ourselves and asking to sit at the table. And I think because of all the great work that's come before me and all the great foundation folks in the field have laid, like, I think we should just sit at the table now. I think we should push back when people don't understand our field. I don't think we should apologize for ourselves anymore. And I hope that over the next months and years will be a big part of my work, is sort of working to empower other people in palliative care to try to sort of claim our seat at the table and own it, and continue hoping to take the education more upstream. There's a lot of great folks doing kind of what I think of the public facing palliative care education, and using social media and writing and the lay press to really demystify and educate the general public about palliative care, which I think is huge and so important. And I also worry that no matter how excited the public gets about palliative care, there's still so much gatekeeping that if they go to their doctor and say, oh, I'd like to meet the palliative care team, and the doctor says, oh, no, you don't need it, you're not there yet, the conversation's over. And so what I sort of see as my vision for my next years of work is working on the healthcare system and bringing it education upstream and in medical school and residency, doing more education about palliative care, what it is and what it isn't, and really trying to have come from both sides. So hoping the general public gets good education and myth and misconception busting about palliative care, and then also healthcare workers, so that everyone kind of meet in the middle, and that we can, as a field, kind of take our place among all the other specialties at saying, you know, we're here and our goal is just to make people's life better. And there's nothing scary about that. The scary things have already happened. The only thing that's going to happen now, if you meet a palliative care team, is that hopefully your life's going to get better and your symptoms are going to be better controlled, and you'll be able to better understand your medical care. You'll be better able to plan for the future. And it's all such value adds that I think there's no reason to be scared of it. And I think most people aren't. We should stop projecting that and telling people what to be afraid of.
You know, I'm going to land there. Government, policymakers, whoever it is, needs to step up their game and do a better job of giving us more voice and choice. I do understand that the healthcare game is stuck. There's still this control as to how we do things, and rightfully so. There are some areas that you just can't be open and free to allow. But I do believe that the lives that we have can be, you know, kept prolonged and stretched out if we had choices. Not that we are able to kind of choose, but I think that we should have better explanations as to how this works. And being able to have these teams available, at least people who can honor the conversations, because many a times we are put in situations where surgery becomes an option. It's probably not the best thing to do. Sometimes we're put in situations to take people off some sort of medication, maybe even machinery, because we didn't have the correct information. And I'm asking people to get proxies and to get family members who can equip them with the information to never give up, because there's still hope. There's still ways that we can do this. And I need us to fight together. So big up to you and to your team. And we're sending positive energy one more time your way for this. Before we let you go, the floor is yours. Tell us what you want our listeners to remember about this movement, about the next steps, not only in your field, but what you want to see moving forward.
So I think the big message is that, you know, palliative care, it's all the things we talked about. It's helping you live your best life. It's improving your quality of life. It's helping you plan for the future if that's what you want to do. And it's helping make sure that every day is as good as possible. I think, like you mentioned with, you know, talk healthcare proxies, I think everyone should have a healthcare proxy. I think everyone should talk to the people they love about what they want and don't want. And I've seen over and over again what a gift it can be for people to who are in a situation where they need to be making a decision for another person, to know that they're making the right decision and to know that they're making the decision that that person would want to make for themselves if they could speak. So give your loved ones and your family members that gift of talking about what you want, and ask your loved ones what they would want for their healthcare, and start having these conversations.
That's the best way to kind of see this for us. Look at yourself, get the best self. And let's get the leadership going within our family sets, because true leaders are those who share their gifts. They expose their own peaks and valleys so that the path is cleared up for the leaders who follow the trail. Because on this platform, it was built, because way too often as people, we were overlooked or labeled. But this is no longer. Our plight and our fight is for anyone and everyone who feels a need to be understood. We are strong as individuals, but unstoppable when we unite. Tune in, friends, to another He's Just a Social Worker show, coming to another town real soon, near you. We're out. Thank you so much, friend. Amazing.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. This has been a wonderful conversation.
Please note that the views expressed here are my own and not a representation of my employers and clients. Thank you for listening. We're always here for you. Just message us and we'll get back to you within 24 hours. Thank you. More than just at He's Just a Social Worker. In memory of my mother, Matilde De La Rosa, this is dedicated to you, Mom. Miss you so much. En memoria de mi madre, Matilde De La Rosa, esto va dedicado a ti, Mamá. Te extraño mucho.